Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Barry Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. This show is also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Desiree Mays. She is here to talk to us about the opera. This is the, what is it, the fourth?
Fourth one we're into
in
now,
our
yes.
series of Monday opera programs. And Desiree is the author of Opera Unveiled, the book that comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera. And we are talking about all five of the operas. And today is a very interesting opera. It's called Tea, A Mirror of Soul. And every year the Santa Fe Opera does one opera by a living contemporary composer. And this is it, Chinese composer Tan Dun.
Yes, this is one of the great strengths of the Santa Fe Opera. And it was something John Crosby started many years ago, presenting new opera to American audiences. They can be from any part of the world, the composers, they're commissioned either just by the Santa Fe Opera or on a shared commission basis. Daphne, for instance, was not premiered at the Santa Fe Opera, but the first American performance of Daphne was at Santa Fe. And that it's a rather similar situation here. Tea, A Mirror of Soul, which is wonderful. I'm so excited to talk about this piece because I think it probably does need a little introduction. The premiere of this opera was in 2002 in Tokyo. And this was a co-commissioned work with Shanghai, where it actually hasn't yet appeared. It's going to be appearing in Chinese in Shanghai. There's been a lot of political maneuvering, apparently, to get it done. But also with the Netherlands, and it has been performed in Amsterdam. In fact, the conductor who conducted at Amsterdam will be conducting the American premiere here.
Len, let's make the point that although Tan Dun is a Chinese composer, the opera is in English.
The opera is in English, yes. And even though the sound is very often Chinese and Japanese and European, you'll hear all of it in this music. We will have the titles on the back of the seat, so you'll be able to follow.
Well, I have to say, having seen the DVD and knowing that it was in English, the only words I understood in the whole thing were tea and Your Majesty.
I'm glad you got tea.
It is the name of the opera, and the word does appear a great deal. But that's one of the things about opera. Even when it's sung in a language that you know, you still can't understand it.
No, and just today I was reading from a composer that this is always a problem. You're almost better listening to an opera in a foreign language because you're not struggling then. So read the titles, and it takes
just
care of it.
Just read the titles at the Santa Fe Opera.
And it's very poetic, this particular libretto. Tan Dun wrote the libretto with Zhu Ying, who is the playwright for the Chinese National Theater. It's sort of a shared effort, and he loves the poetry in this piece. Sadly, you can't see the poetry on the written page because it, too, has a shape on its own on the page. But because it's sung, all of that is lost in an opera.
And it's amazing because the poetry is so carefully composed that it makes perfect triangles and diamond shapes
on
the written page.
Yes, it does. And maybe we'll read a little, we'll hear a little bit of this music. Maybe we should jump in and just play some of the beginning of Tea so people will begin to get a sense of the sound, and then we can talk about Tea and Tan Dun. The opera opens in a monastery in Kyoto, a tea garden, and with the chief, the lead monk singing the lines of the tea ceremony. There are actually, I counted them, 7 tea ceremonies in this opera, Chinese and Japanese. They go from one to the other. But the whole thing is a metaphor for a love story. Here he sings, the monk sings, the growing tea is hard, picking tea is harder, savoring tea is the hardest, Princess Lan and Prince Sekio. So here we have the names of the two lead characters. Prince Sekio is himself, and he now is in a monastery at the end of the story, and the opera takes us back into what happened 10 years before. So let's hear the opening of this. You'll hear the monk-like chant, and then there's a transition section where we are taken back 10 years from Japan to China, where where we meet the prince and the princess Lan. These are a brother and sister, and they're reenacting, they're play-acting a play called The Monkey King, which was is a very famous Chinese play, one of the renowned Chinese novels that goes back 400 years about the adventures of a monkey king. So that they're reenacting the story, they're sort of play acting in a very stylized way. The costumes and setting of this opera are very unfamiliar to us, but let's hear the opening of the opera and the section of the tea hymn, if you like, into the transition to China. So now we are back in the land of tea, a mirror of soul, in China, where the brother and sister, the prince and princess Lan, are reenacting this play for their father, the emperor, who's thrilled with the children's play. And then a visitor arrives. It is Prince Sekio. Sekio, years ago, had met Lan, and they must have exchanged promises, because now he has come back to claim her. And the next section I'd like to play you is about...
Claim her. Marry her?
Yeah, officially.
Meaning sweep her away?
Yes, absolutely. Make the official proposal. There was a very clear process in how this could be done in the court of China at the time. We're talking about 9th century China, the Tang dynasty, whichever way you pronounce it. So Sekio arrives, and the prince is not happy to see him. The prince is very close to his sister, and he is not happy that this family unit be broken up. So in this section, the emperor is listening to Sekio and to his proposal, and in order to be able to win Lan, he has to first compose a poem on the spur of the moment. This was common. And Sekio says, choose a theme, please. And the theme is tea. So do you have it there? You can maybe read that first, the first tea poem.
Tea, sensual green, a watery beauty, up floating dreams, down sinking leaves. If one desires to live forever, taste a thick and light bowl of tea.
So an extraordinary topic, you would think, to win a bride, but it works. So let's hear a little of that section. The beginning is the duet between the emperor who says, in our palace we thrive on art. If you catch the phoenix, you must feed her first with a poem, which is beautiful. But the prince is angry, a fool for love. In our home we thrive on Lan. If you take my sister, you first break my heart with a sword.
Desires to live forever, taste a thick and light bowl of tea. Now,
again, this sound is different to our ears, but I really feel, Mary Charlotte, with new opera, you have to be really open to new sounds. If we don't have any opera from now, the 21st century, there will be nothing from our time period. It's going to change. It has. The history of opera has changed. I mean, we've gone from Baroque to this. I mean, that's extraordinary. It's the same art form, but the two operas bear very little resemblance to one another.
Well, what would you call the style of this opera, Tea, A Mirror of Soul?
Tandon is very unique in that I think he very consciously strives to blend styles. He always says that his music is inspired by his childhood in China, so that's the root source. But then he came to Colombia, where he was exposed to minimalist music, John Cage, people like this, and that influenced him. And he decided he really wanted to make a fusion of these sounds, and he really does this well in this music. One extraordinary aspect of his music that we'll hear in some of these excerpts are his use of organic instruments, which means he uses water and pots and paper, I mean, things of the earth, with extraordinary effect. So, for instance, he uses paper, hanging sheets of paper that hang from the above the flies down onto the stage, that rustle in the wind, there's that wonderful sound. At one point, the percussionist actually beats with drumsticks onto the paper. Now, in Santa Fe, this is going to be very interesting, because with our wind up on that stage, the paper's going to do its own thing. It will not obey the score.
You can't make it rustle the way you want to.
It really can't. But that's an integral part of the score. With stones, he takes stones and he beats them together so you get that sound. Water is used extraordinarily. He has three young girls all dressed in black, percussionists, with clear glass bowls of water. And they just dip their hands into the water and they let the drops of water drop back into the bowl.
That's part of the music.
That's part of the score. It's quite beautiful. At other points, it's actually in the section I just played, they take little pots and they just pop them on top of the water. You get a popping sound. That's very effective. Tandon has actually said that he has used all of these instruments with a purpose. Each one means rebirth. Water is rebirth. The stones are fate. He uses ceramic pots that are beaten on the side, so you get that wonderful sounds of the pot. These are all integral to the score, along with the Japanese, Chinese, Western sound. It's all in there.
And American.
Yes. We just found strains of Aaron Copland,
which I hadn't noticed,
but I think yes is quite true. Tandon was not only an opera composer and a composer of many wonderful classical pieces, he's also the composer of the score for the soundtrack of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with.
And which won, I think, a Grammy and an Oscar.
It did. It won both a Grammy and an Oscar. I think nobody was more surprised than Tandon. He had composed it as a favor to a friend and suddenly won a Grammy and an Oscar. So that's a movie people should go see if you want to get a sense of his music and those flight, literally, of his music. That's a good warm-up for the opera.
Very interesting.
So, well, let's get back to the story quickly. I'll just tell you the story, then we can talk about some of these features. The prince, then there's a sort of a knock at the door. This happens a lot in opera, so to speak, on the palace in China. And there's a prince outside offering 1,000 horses for a book. So the emperor said, "What is this book?" And the prince tells him, "It's the Book of Tea. This is a book of philosophy, a book of yin and yang. It marks the inner linear spaces of the soul." And that he and Lan have been studying this book. And the prince Sekio says to him, he says, "You don't have the true book." And the two men get into an argument. This is, again, a triangular love story. The brother who loves the sister and the lover who comes to take her away. They get in an argument over the authenticity of the book. Does the prince have the true book? Sekio says no. He says, "I know Lu Yu, who is the sage of tea, who wrote the book. He has the book." So they get into this big argument, and it ends where they vow that whoever finds the true book, the other will forfeit his life to that one.
About which the sister or wife-to-be probably doesn't feel very good because it's her fiancé and her brother.
Exactly. She's caught right in the middle. So at the end of one second, she just screams almost no, realizing the implication of this. So what happens then is that Sekio and Lan go off to find Lu Yu. They arrive at his place in China to find only his daughter Lu, who has the book. And Lu gives them the Book of Tea on condition that they will spread its word through love, their love. And that's how they get to be given the book. And Lan takes it in that spirit, but Sekio doesn't. Sekio says, "I have the book. I've won. I've won the bet." And she is torn. She says, "You win a book. I lose a brother." So it's a wonderfully poignant moment. And at that point, who shows up but the prince? He has followed them and he comes, the brother, and he snatches the book from her hand and they get into this terrible fight. The two men draw their swords. They're going to fight for the book. And as Lan tries to protect both of them and stop the fight, she gets right in the middle, and her brother's sword pierces her heart, and she dies. So Lan is dead, and the prince at that point kneels before Seikyo and realizing the horror of what has happened, he says, "My life is forfeit to you." But Seikyo, in the Buddhist Zen spirit of the peace, will not take his life. He cuts off his own hair, and then the opera just fades back to the first scene, back to the temple in Kyoto, where Seikyo is telling the story and once again reciting the tea poem. So it's a simple story. It's a triangular love story, a brother who loses a sister, and they fight over a book.
And there's a great irony because, in the book are the whole explications of the best qualities of tea, which include tranquility and peace and all these things. And they're having a fight to the death over a book about peace.
Yes, exactly. There's the irony of that. And we can talk maybe a little bit about the whole tea connection and how it works as a metaphor. But maybe first we could play another section that is a good example of the sound of the ceramic pots. Listen to the percussion, the Chinese percussion here. This is a Chinese tea ceremony, China tea ceremony. So it's a very different sound to our ears. But maybe we could play that next.
We're talking about the opera Tea, A Mirror of Soul with Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, the book that comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. We're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, about the opera, which is at the Santa Fe Opera this summer, Tea, A Mirror of Soul by the Chinese composer Tan Dun.
Yes, this is going to be the American premiere, which is going to be exciting. The first performance is on the 21st of July, and that day people should know. There's going to be a wonderful discussion with the production team and hopefully Tan Dun himself. He will be here. It'll be at the James A. Little Theater at 10 o'clock. So that's something not to miss. It's quite wonderful to hear directly from a composer, the director, some of the singers, and on the day of first performance. So that's July 21st, the opening night.
Let's talk about the title, Tea, A Mirror of Soul. I mean, there's a tremendous significance, symbolic and cultural and everything else, in tea that gets played out in this opera.
Exactly. And I mean, what does it mean? Tea, mirror, and soul. Those are three pretty heavy-duty words. So the whole opera is a metaphor. And as I mentioned, there are seven tea ceremonies. So what is going on here? What is the connection between tea and this love story? It turns out that the tea ceremony rests – I'm going to read just a little bit from Opera Unveiled. The tea ceremony rests on four principles – harmony with people and nature, respect for others, purity of heart and mind, and tranquility. The ceremonies combine many Eastern philosophies. The bitter taste of tea can refer to Buddhist suffering. In Confucianism, the tea ceremony teaches harmony and balance. In Taoism, tea represents the essence of nature – believing that every act of living is important and beauty may be found everywhere in the world. The ritual of tea recognizes that the mundane and the particular are as important as the spiritual and universal. The formalized acts of politeness in the tea ceremony are the outward expressions of an inner belief in the value of peace and harmony, thus the opera's subtitle, A Mirror of Soul. I hope that helps. But I think Tan Dun draws on all of these philosophies, which are his background and belief system. I mean, he was raised in a shamanic tradition in southern China that was amazingly not knocked out of him in the years of Mao Zedong and Mao's revolution. He lived through that time.
He was sent to re-education training, and they tried to, you know, the Cultural Revolution tried to drive that out of him, but did not succeed.
For a few years, he was taken from his family to be re-educated by the peasants. He tended pigs and planted rice. But what he did at that time, he was in his mid-teens, he became interested in the folk songs of the area and the region, so he collected folk songs, and he was the master of ceremonies at any little event, a wedding or a birth or whatever it was. So when an extraordinary accident, if you believe in accidents, happened. The Peking Opera was coming to town, and they had to cross a river to get to wherever he was. And the ship capsized, and some of the musicians drowned, and they needed musicians. So when they got to the town, Tan Dun applied and was taken on board as a musician in the Peking Opera. I mean, what an incredible way out of that whole... talk about joining the circus, running away. He did. But at that time, the Peking Opera was only allowed to perform Mao's eight model plays. We've all seen this on film in those terrible drab costumes, and his philosophy was hammered home. No reference to the old aristocratic, very beautiful tradition of Peking opera. And that ended when Mao died and they opened the conservatory. And he was taken in as a student. He'd never hardly heard of Beethoven and Mozart. They had been banned. But now he had the contemporary Takamitsu, George Crumb. These were the influences that he heard in the conservatory. And then he was offered a scholarship to Columbia University, came to the States, where he was blitzed by new sound and the whole experience of Western music. Amazing. And rather lost his balance, he said, at that point in terms of composition, but eventually came through that period. And I think this is how this blending and meshing of music is so great with him, because his history is so built into the music at every level. I mean, what we've heard is very Chinese. There's some reminiscences of Western music as well, along with this extraordinary organic sound. He even has the musicians get in on the act. They have to vocalize certain sounds at certain points. And you know how musicians carefully turn the pages of their music so they don't make a sound. He has the entire orchestra turn the pages loudly in unison, so you get a sh- 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 sound. It's wonderful. And in the early performances, he actually had the orchestra on stage. This man does not believe in division between cultures, between people, between religions. He's a true universalist.
So maybe his re-education did work.
Well, it wasn't the way Mao intended, however. but when you talk to him and listen to his music, I think that's really clear. So in the production, the orchestra is actually on stage. And again, there's a wonderful DVD of this that you can get at the opera shop. And I would again encourage people to pick this up. You'll see the orchestra on stage. You'll see Tan Dun conducting. And they become a part of the production itself. They're sort of side by side. There isn't a division between performers and orchestra as there usually is. So a lot of his philosophy, I think, is built into that. We should talk maybe a little bit about that. He's not going to be directing or conducting here, sadly.
No, but it is very interesting when you have a living contemporary composer, what that person's role is in the staging of the opera. I mean, it's one thing they write the score, they create the opera, but then can they tell you what the staging is like? Do they want to be involved? Do they want to leave that creativity to directors and other people? Do they let go of it? What about Tan Dun?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And in this case, I mean, it's the traditional story of the writer who is ordered off the set when his book becomes a movie. Yeah. They're usually not allowed to have any say at all. This, again, will vary from production to production. But Tan Dun has been at the center of this piece from day one. The premiere he conducted, he was there. Now, here, as I say, he won't be conducting. but he has worked very closely with the director that we are having here. The director is Armin Miyamoto. He comes actually with a team of people who are very famous in Japan as theater directors, actually, and they have collaborated closely with Tandon in New York on how this production will be, because it'll be different. I think this is a piece that each time it comes to a new house, it will be different. Apparently, the production team were blown away by the Santa Fe Opera because it's an organic theater.
Yeah.
It's exactly what this piece is all about, and they were really excited about that. So,
well, if there's a John Cage influence and that kind of thing, then all the unexpected circumstances like wind blowing through or things falling from the sky are going to be part of the piece.
Right, right. And how the costuming on the DVD, the costuming is all in a sort of shades of white, but you can use brilliant color with this. So I think there's a lot of leeway. Amon Miyamoto is the will be the director. Rui Matsui, the scenic designer, and Masatoma Ota will be the costume designer. So we have this team who are coming in who, with Tandon on the sidelines in this particular instance, will be putting it together. But as I say, he has been central to the other productions. And we do have Hai Jung Fu, who the baritone we've heard sing Seikyo, who was in the very first performance, will be singing here in Santa Fe, that wonderful, beautiful baritone voice. I'm looking forward to hearing and meeting him.
So do we have a music selection?
Yes, let's hear now maybe the vow where the two men, the prince and Seikyo, vow to give their lives to the other to whoever finds the book. And maybe afterwards we'll talk a little bit about the book itself. But as you listen to this piece, you'll hear the tension building gradually as the two men become more and more angry. And finally, you'll hear the anguished cry of Lan as she realizes what this vow means as she cries out, "No."
Yeah.
And the anguished cry, no, when she realizes that somebody she loves is going to die.
One of the two, yes.
Her brother or her fiancé.
Yes, the standard love triangle that you find in opera, the baritone, the tenor, and the soprano.
But you usually don't find it between a brother, sister, and the lover.
Yeah. Well, unless you're talking about Wagner. But that's a very strong bond, the family unit, which is being broken up and was very important in ancient China, apparently. This is a cultural thing that we may not tie into as obviously as they would.
Now, in your research for this particular chapter of Opera Unveiled, Desiree, you looked into this whole question of what is this Book of Tea?
Exactly. You know, what is tea all about? I mean, being Irish, I was raised on tea, of course. I mean, we have cups of tea at the drop of a hat. If you arrive at an Irish house, after you say hello, you say, would you like a cup of tea, or I'll put the kettle on. And you know there is a ritual. We do have a ritual of tea. We don't really think of it as such.
As a ceremony.
As a ceremony, yeah. Well, it has to be the right temperature. Do you put the milk in first? My mother is adamant about that. Tea, milk goes first before the tea, and it has to sit and brew for so long. You know, there is a ritual to it. And then finally you sit down with a friend, and you have a cup of tea, and you have a little time out. It's a time to relax. And that's exactly what these tea ceremonies are about. So I was intrigued. I mean, suddenly I'm going to research tea. I mean, was that intriguing? So I started phoning around this town. This town is so great. I found a wonderful tea master teacher in Frank Murphy who appeared on the show, invited us both to tea. And I discovered that China tea drinking is about, there is ritual, but it's about drinking tea. I mean, many cups of tea, it's about the actual drinking of tea. Whereas in the Japanese ceremony, it's much more about ceremony. It's much more of a Zen-like approach. You don't drink very much tea. In fact, people who've been through that ceremony, and you have a small, the cup is important, the way you turn it, and you drink matcha, which is a sort of frothy green tea. So there are two different rituals here. And maybe I should mention as part of the summer events here, Sunrise Springs, which is a lovely resort just a little south of Santa Fe, does offer Japanese tea ceremony. You can go out and experience the ceremony out there. And they're having a whole number of events that are around tea ceremonies during the time of tea, which I think will be nice.
And Frank Murphy will be doing Chinese tea events in association with the Santa Fe Opera.
That's right, yes, and you should call the opera if you want to find out about those, because he is not to be missed. Those are great. So the origins of tea itself, I mean, this is then the next thing. Where does tea come from? What about the Book of Tea? Who is Lu Yu? Tea apparently goes back to the 3rd millennium BC in China. I mean, that's amazing. I had no idea. It was used as a medicine and a food spice before becoming a tea drink at the time of Confucius. It's a plant that grows to about 50 feet tall, has a lifespan of 70 years. But when they produce tea, apparently they keep the plant very low and small and curtailed for the best leaves. It was always known for its calming effect and the shared mood of beauty and harmony.
Which isn't what we think about. We think about the caffeine buzz.
Yes, and that's part of it, you know.
But as we learned from Frank Murphy, the way you brew it and the kind of tea it is brings out different qualities in the tea.
Yes, and that whole caffeine buzz was interesting because it goes right back to the story of how they think tea got from to Japan from China. There was a 12th century Zen Buddhist monk called Issei who brought the tea seeds back from China to Japan for a very good reason. He found that the caffeine in the tea would allow the monks to be able to meditate and stay focused much longer if they were drinking tea. So that was how apparently it got from one country to the other. And then I think it was the 16th century that the great tea master Rikyu began the tradition of the Japanese ceremony, which has been passed down generation to generation till we have the Japanese Cha no Yu ceremony today. These are the origins of tea. In the 8th century, this scholar, Chinese man called Lu Yu, wrote a book called The Book of Tea. And that book is still around. There's a translation. The opera, I think, has copies of that. And he makes this a philosophy, a ritual. He talks about the picking, the production, the ritual of tea, and how right thinking, right moving, all the sort of Buddhist, Zen, Taoist philosophies are wrapped in this book. So the Book of Tea is very important, and it's very real. It's a real book, and it is at the center of this whole opera. So I think the fact that Tan Dan picked up on this and use this as the anchor from which to build an opera was quite extraordinary, because his most recent opera, The First Emperor, just premiered at the Metropolitan New Opera, Metropolitan New York, is an enormous undertaking. It's a grand opera on the grand scale about the first Chinese emperor who built the Wall of China, a very different cup of tea, if excuse the pun, but this one is his third. He wrote one on Marco Polo, which was not so much about Marco Polo's journey as about the journey we all make through life, the challenges, the joys, the sadnesses. It's about journeying. And then one called Peony Pavilion, which is more set in an Asian setting. So very versatile, very accessible, and a little different hearing to our ears. But this is a piece of opera theater. You have to see it. It all comes as a package, the sound, the image, the visuals, all together.
And the air that you're breathing in the night sky and everything
up
else.
Up at Santa Fe, exactly. It's going to be, you'll be very conscious of that in this production. It should be very exciting.
We have time for one more music selection.
It's hard to know which to choose at this point. Maybe I'll play you one with some really great rhythms. When Lu welcomes Lan and Sekio and gives them the book, there's some lovely rhythmical sections in here that gives another sort of sense of what the opera is about. Maybe we could hear that one next. There's wonderful rhythm in that. I mean, really jazzy. I mean, there are moments of this that are quite jazzy. So you're going to hear a lot of different things in Tan Dan's Tea, A Mirror of Soul. At moments, it's very zen-like and very meditative. And opera, contemporary opera, new opera, much of it is going in that direction, which I think is wonderful. It doesn't end with a great big chord and a happy ending or a tragic death. There's something contemplative, meditative, something to think about, food for thought, along with tea. It's great.
We've talked about orchestras a little bit, but this is an orchestra where the bassoons and violins get the night off.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they're there, but he has flutes, clarinets, trumpets, trombones, harp, percussionists, strings, not a lot. And then mainly these very interesting percussionists who play these organic instruments, which are a part of the whole. If you listen carefully, you'll pick them up. But it's a piece, as I say, that you need to see, and it'll be great when he's here. We will get to hear from him too, I hope, on the 21st of July.
There's something that I've been meaning to ask you during all of these weeks, and that is, you have opera singers who are trained at to have wonderful lung capacity, but we are at a pretty high altitude.
Yeah. At 7,000 feet, singing is a real challenge. And there's two things. One is that once the singers come in here, they are expected to stay. They are not supposed to jet set round to other opera houses, flying on airplanes and going up and down in altitude.
So they can get used to the altitude.
So that they are acclimatized. They have a slightly longer rehearsal period too, which gives them time to acclimate. And this the main point of the altitude here is that the opera company has to be very careful in what repertoire it chooses. We cannot do Wagner really here because they're very long operas. It takes incredible stamina, very big orchestras and big voices who can maintain that level for hours on end. It's very difficult, which is one of the reasons we really don't present Wagner.
Oh, isn't that a shame? But do they have oxygen off
stage?
Oh,
yes, they do. Yeah, the first time I saw Don Giovanni here, Don Giovanni opens with a sword fight. It was pretty wild sword fight. So the Don is out there doing the sword fight, flies off into the wings, takes a quick swig of oxygen before going back on. So there are lots of opera stories about that. It's there all the time for the singer's use if they need it. Typically, by the time they come to performance, they are ready for it. But we have had singers who just couldn't hack it. I mean, as people come here to Santa Fe and find they can't manage living at this altitude, it's too tough.
And what happens? They have to get a replacement?
Hmm. They're all covered. Every role is covered. And there's been some wonderful success stories of the cover who goes on. I mean, there's magic new careers have been started here because of that. Typically, these are drawn from the apprentice program. The young apprentices are assigned to cover these leading roles and very often do get to sing them for one reason or another.
So in rehearsal, how long for an opera, for example, like Tea, A Mirror of Soul, is the ensemble going to be rehearsing?
I think about a month ahead of time. I'm not sure exactly. Let you know next week exactly the time period, but longer than most houses have. Typically, especially with a known opera, the leads will come in and virtually expect to walk through traditional placings, which doesn't give the cohesiveness and the wonderful holistic effect that our operas here in Santa Fe do, because we do have that longer rehearsal time. You can do more with staging. People know better where you know, the director has much more leeway to do different new things with them.
And do the apprentices rehearse as well?
Oh, yes, of course. They're here to study, and they play the small roles, sometimes chorus, and to cover. So they are part, I mean, the apprentices will sing in three or four operas as long as the rehearsal schedule doesn't overlap. The Santa Fe Opera has a number of rehearsal halls up there that are going full tilt from through June, of course. We mount one opera a week. That's an enormous undertaking, and the scheduling is very tight. And in fact, we're in the process of building new rehearsal halls so that we can extend that. The young singers are coached here. They actually audition. Most of the leading managements in the world come to Santa Fe during the summer to audition the apprentice singers here and to contract them for other work. This looks very good on their resumes.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much, Desiree Mays, for being here with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
And we have one more to go, Così fan tutte of Mozart next week.
That's right, that's next week. Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled, the book that comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera. The book is available at the Santa Fe Opera or at any local bookstore. And you will also be lecturing about each opera.
At the preview buffets each night, yes.
And if you want to find out more, you can also go on the web to santafeopera.org. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and this show is podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Tim Pemberton for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Thank you.
Here.